From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with a phone that was thrown into a pool. Amy Likens Lawson won't allow her two youngest children, 13-year-old Lucian and 12-year-old Sophia, to have cell phones. She told the Washington Post that it's complicated because the family is temporarily living in Abu Dhabi, and Lucian and Sophia want phones to communicate with their friends back home and with new friends living in their neighborhoods. When their dad upgraded his cell phone and gave his old one to Lucian, Amy allowed him to have it, but she created strict rules. And when she found him checking the phone late one night, she, quote, chucked it in the pool, Lucian said. Amy Likens Lawson is one of several parents recently interviewed by the Washington Post about not allowing their kids to have smartphones. According to a 2019 report by Common Sense Media, 53% of American kids have a smartphone by age 11. 89% of kids have a smartphone by the time they are 16. A campaign called Wait Until 8th encourages parents and caregivers to wait until their children are in 8th grade to give them smartphones. Experts say social media's effects on tweens and teens contribute to anxiety and depression, among other psychological effects, so waiting is best. This hour, we're joined by the experts who weigh in on smartphone and social media use and about screen time recommendations, holding out, saying no, and being strong. I'd like to welcome our guests now. Dr. Elizabeth Murray is an assistant professor of pediatrics and a pediatrician at Golisano Children's Hospital. Dr. Murray, welcome back to the program.
Hello, talking to you on my smartphone right now.
On your smartphone, Dr. Steve Cook, I think the same, associate professor of pediatrics and a pediatrician at Golisano Children's Hospital. Yes, Steve?
Yes, I'm here. Thanks. I'm on my smartphone. I couldn't find the landline.
All right, very good. And welcome to Faith Rogo, who is an author and a media literacy specialist and curriculum developer at InsidersEducation.com. Hi, Faith. Thank you for being with us.
Hi, great to be with you.
Last night, Dr. Cook was mentioning to me that when the wait until 8th idea came out, there was a misunderstanding about 8 or 8th. Can you explain? I found this kind of amazing, Dr. Cook.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it was wait until 8, I think people started saying very quickly, and it's meant to be 8th as in 8th grade as opposed to 8 years of age. And that was a number of years ago. When I had seen that come out, and I think it's still very true, and I worry about, you know, it creeping into the hands of kids even younger, because I don't think it's a matter of just giving them a phone. It's a matter of their access to it and how we kind of watch that.
Wait until 8th, not 8, which, you know, I mean, let me ask all three of our guests this. The idea that there would be confusion here, that the campaign would be mistaken to mean wait until 8 years old, implies to me that parents, some parents at least, are looking for a reason to say yes and give their kids a phone. If they're like, well, if the AAP says, you know, the experts say 8 years old, so let's do it. You know, at least we can check in, et cetera. I'm sure that's not all parents, but Dr. Cook, do you think there are more parents than we realize who are looking for a reason to say yes on this?
Oh, I know there are. I think it's a matter of, you know, as parents, it's hard to be a parent, and things that can help us, we look at as things, you know, that are to our benefit. And we, all of us act very short term and think short term and not what the long term complications of that are. So you're absolutely right. People are looking for an acceptable trigger point. And if that's a even bigger one they think of, then we got to get our message right.
What do you think, Dr. Murray?
Yeah, I mean, I think that parents want to be able to have communication with their kids. I don't know that they're thinking their kids need the full set of things that potentially come along with a smartphone, but the accessibility, you know, with maybe two parents working, kids doing sports, after school events, walking to school, different things. I think more parents are thinking they want to have some connection to their kids.
Yeah, and Dr. Murray, this to me brings back to mind the conversation with a number of camp directors in recent years who tell me that, yes, cell phones are a problem at summer camps, you know, but it's often more difficult to get the parents to part with it. In other words, you know, the kids may want to use the cell phone, but they're at camp, they're at overnight camp, they'll give it up. But they hear from, the camp directors hear from parents who say, well, look, I got to be able to text. I got to be able to check in. You got to let them have it. I mean, it's just interesting to me that it's not just the kids who may want this.
Right, and I think that's true. That camp thing is interesting because I do feel like camp is different. Camp is a special situation where, you know, there are adults around you. I'm thinking of a situation, if a child is responsible for walking home after school, especially during the pandemic, we lost a lot of busing capabilities. And so you could see a parent wanting to make sure they could check in and, make sure their child got home, make sure things are going okay, when they're in our environment, but perhaps need to check in. That's very different than being away at camp where there probably isn't power. So that's kind of a different vibe. But it is interesting. If you get used to it and it's easy, you could understand. And I think that's important to remember that a lot of cell phone usage has to do with how we model the behavior. And, kids are going to do what we do because they're going to learn it from us. So a lot of this is on the parents.
Dr. Rogo, how much of this is generated by peer pressure and friend groups where the first cell phone, no matter what age, is going to prompt the kids to want to have a domino effect with it?
I don't know that we have definitive research on that question, but I think your earlier question kind of got to it, that at least in the early years, it seems to be much more driven by parent desire than by kids keeping in touch with each other, unless they're engaged in a specific thing. And ironically, I think, one of the I don't know if it's a driver or keeps kids from it, but that very young kids use tablets a lot, and many of them use them for great things, some of them not so much, but I think a lot of parents approach this as, well, this is just part of real life, and a lot of real life has changed. So, when I was a kid, if you were out someplace and you needed to call in for one reason or another, there was a payphone available. There isn't anymore, right?
Yeah.
So then you have to answer the question of, okay, so how do I equip my kid out there when they need to be able to call in? Or how do I keep them safe? There are things like that. I think peer pressure is way down on the list for initial purchase of phones.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. By the way, we tell kids now, not only were there payphones, but you had to memorize people's numbers. Like, you had to actually know the numbers. Couldn't look at your hand and have numbers unless you had things written down. It's amazing. The whole world has changed. But I want to talk about a couple of really, I think, central questions here. And as we do that, I would love to hear from listeners about what lines you are drawing with kids on when they're starting. Screens, getting their own phone entirely, and how difficult or maybe not difficult that's been. 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. I want to talk a little bit about addiction and how we think about addiction. The Washington Post writes that a report by Common Sense Media back in 2019 found that 50% of teenagers said that they felt addicted to their smartphones, and 59% of their parents would have said that about their kids. And that's just those who are admitting it. I mean, when half of American teenagers are saying, yes, I think I'm probably addicted to my smartphone, and half are saying, no, I'm fine. What percentage of the group that says, no, I'm fine, is actually lying to themselves? It's a lot of kids who feel always on it and like they cannot be away from it. And I don't know where addiction starts. I mean, Dr. Cook, addiction is sort of it's a clinical thing, right? I mean, I don't know, what are the lines that we draw to say, hey, you're kind of using it too much versus the kid's got a problem?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough part when you have a young child. And I've seen that. The statement before is, yes, kids have tons of screens, and that's the problem. I think the misperception, oh, it's a phone. It's not a phone. It's a computer. And essentially, whether it's a tablet or it's a phone, it's not about calling people. And sadly, that's the thing that's used minimal, texting. But, searching on the internet, entertainment, things like that are what's used. And being able to drop away from it is really hard. And again, role modeling is part of this too. When I see parents, I go into a room for a young child and a parent is holding a phone and looking at a phone, and I can't ask a three-year-old what's going on, you know, that really discourages me of what's happening. So you have to look at that and say, you know, we've normalized it to the point that it is really interfering. I would argue that it should be thought of almost like as an addiction because it's replacing so much of our life. And if you want to take a very strict criteria, like, you know, do you have problems when it's taken away? Can you not cope with it? Are you having trouble, you know, legal trouble if you don't have it perhaps? So that's a hard thing to pinpoint, but when you can take it away and not have any regret from it and have any problems, then you can feel a little more assured. But I mean, that's the hard problem. And when I see parents with that, it's really tough and they want someone else to help them say no too, which unfortunately is our role. And we want to empower parents to make sure it's their role as well.
Yeah. What do you think, Dr. Murray?
So you remember, these things are all tools. And so tools have a skill set associated with them and we have to learn a skill. And I think that we forget that. And especially parents now kind of, you know, they were alive before there were smartphones, many of them, most of them. And so, you know, it was just kind of thrown on top of us. And now we have a generation that has the opportunity to learn about being a digital citizen and kind of learning that skill. And I think, you know, we have a little bit of catching up to do. You know, could people truly be addicted to it? Of course. Is it, you know, the connectivity through the social media apps? Yes. Is it addiction to texting? Probably not so much. I worry much more so about the interactions on the apps and the posts and things along those lines. But again, this is a skill and we have to learn it as parents and we have to teach it to our kids so that we're using it safely and appropriately.
And I realize, Dr. Murray, that parents will have a variety of responses, but I am curious if you ever encounter parents who might be in denial about what is too much for their kids.
I don't know that the thought process goes that far. It's more of just they haven't thought about it. I also think, too, that, again, you know, for younger parents or for parents who perhaps have a limited education themselves, we have to remember that there's something there are upwards of 80,000 apps in the App Store that are labeled as educational, but almost none of them have any data to support that. So you can certainly understand, you know, you have a working parent who might be struggling, who wants to make sure their child has the best, and they think of if my child has some time to use this educational app, you know, I'm helping them. And so, again, that's why I think there's a lot of education that has to go along with this. You know, marketing is powerful, and these apps want to be chosen, and playing on parents' fears or parents' desires is a good way to get their product into people's hands. And so I often hear parents, you know, talk about how it's okay. They're learning. It's an educational app. This is helping them. And in reality, it's not, but they're entering into it with their heart in the right place.
Well, I'm sure if the rules say that an app labeled as educational doesn't need to meet any specific requirements, I'm sure the people who created Fortnite would tell you it's an educational app if they're allowed to do that. So that is a good point. Don't just assume that, this says this is an educational app. Well, a lot of them do. Faith, are you worried about addiction?
Not at all. And part of that isn't because I'm not worried about overuse by some people. I really dislike the framing of addiction. I think it diverts us away from the kinds of things that we actually need to be paying attention to. And I think it's actual addiction is quite rare. And some of it, when we talk about kind of the problematic effects, first, the studies are nearly always, that conclude negative effects are always about heavy use, and then we have problems defining what that is, what heavy use is. But more than that, I think when we use the framing of addiction, we force ourselves into this kind of all-or-nothing approach to technology. Mm. And that, you know, because, if somebody's addicted to a substance, then a big part of the answer for them is staying away from that substance. We don't want them to use that substance. So if we say, well, you're addicted to your phone, then the answer, kind of this shortcut answer, is very much, well, then stay away from your phone or stay off your phone or I'm not going to give you a phone, instead of what kids really need, which is kind of a set of skills and habits and guidelines around how to effectively and ethically and in a healthy way use the technologies that aren't going away, by the way. I mean, they are a part of life. And so we have to now kind of re-gear part of life. And I also want to underscore, I think that part of the problem with addiction framing is that then we think the problem is the child. And I would say in a great number of cases, the problem isn't the child, it's the parents. The first thing I always answer when a parent asks me, well, at what age is okay for a kid to use, you know, for me to get a kid their first phone? And my answer is, at the age you're ready. Because it's not about just whether kids can handle the technology or not. It's about whether parents are ready to do all the things they need to do in order to make phone usage healthy and effective in their family's life. And the kinds of things that parents do with phones influences their kids. And it's not just simple modeling of when you use it. It's being aware of, for instance, we know I deal a lot in very early childhood, and we know that kids need to engage in conversations and see things in practice. So if you go to a restaurant and your kid is on a screen and you're on screens, they're not witnessing typical interactions, even between, say, you and the wait staff, right? They're just not paying attention to that. So they're not learning those social skills. So there are reasons to pay attention to what kids are doing with phones. But I would hate to, you know, when teens say, oh, I feel addicted to my phone, one, that is absolutely not the same thing as saying I'm addicted, right, or being addicted. And two, let's explore what they mean by that. What are they addicted to? If their entire social group is texting, is on a phone, is using a particular app to talk about a particular thing, what they're really telling you is, I don't want to be left out of my social group. And that's a very different thing than I'm addicted to my phone.
Okay. Dr. Cook, agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's a very important point. It's articulated very well that we are jumping to probably the wrong phraseology and kind of identifying the problem at the wrong area at the child. It is the social balance, the social norm, and that's exactly what we have to look at. So children will see and observe and learn whatever is around them, whether it's good or bad. And in this case, if I see parents doing this, I point that out and try to identify it. This is, again, yes, a tool, but not really a tool solely intended for children. And it is that balance. I agree. We unfortunately go to the phrase like addicted too quickly, but it's just the wrong phraseology. When I have a parent, I've asked them to open up a tool on iPhone called Screen Time, and they don't even know it's there, and say, look, you can see exactly how much usage you've had over the past 24 hours or 10 days. And they're shocked by how much they're using. And I've used that as a tool that they can set up to help limit themselves as well as others. But, you know, you have to kind of go out of your way to show people how to limit it. But it's placed on the onus of, in this case, the parent who allows the child to have it and the child to regulate themselves. And, you know, I think we have to sit back and say how much should we really allow them to try to figure out for themselves at a young age.
Okay. Dr. Murray, what do you think?
I really, you know, addiction is a pretty loaded word, and I think that there are a lot of technical aspects to it. As physicians, we appreciate the technical definition, but I could also see how teenagers might feel that way. But, you know, I go back to the, you know, earlier point of parents need to recognize certain skill sets and maturity levels in their child to see when they're ready to handle a new piece of technology, just like we're looking to see, are they ready to handle walking to school by themselves? Are they ready to handle driving a car? You know, kids teach us when they're ready to take on a new phase of life. And at the end of the day, those devices belong to us unless somehow your child has saved up enough money to buy one on their own. There really are devices that we're allowing them to use, and taking that approach and that attitude towards it may help a little bit as well.
Well, Faith, you said that addiction, focusing on addiction, distracts us from the real problems we should be focused on. How do you define them? What are the real problems?
So I actually, as an educator, define the problem as illiteracy, that we don't have or aren't teaching enough people in ways that are at their age levels, developmental levels, and needs, how to use things well. So if all a child is learning about how to use a phone is what their peers do, then chances are they're going to use the phone for entertainment purposes. Ooh, I found this new thing online that you might prefer they not look at, or I'm playing games, I'm watching videos, right, and all of that. So for me, the real answer is going to be some version of media and digital literacy, that this has to become universal, not just in schools, but also giving parents skill sets. You know, you don't send your child out to walk until you've taught them to cross the street safely, right? We don't give children bicycles without usually parents teaching them how to ride that two-wheeler and how to do it safely and where they can ride and things like that. So we have to equip parents with the media literacy skill sets to say, you know, this is a computer in your hands. It can connect you to the world. And some parts of the world aren't really great for you to be in. There is going to be no way, for instance, to teach an eight-year-old to grasp kind of what's out there in the world that they can't see in front of them, but that their phone might connect them to. With teenagers, I think it's a little different. I think they can, and I think they can begin to grapple with the ethical issues and with what's out there and not, and how to engage with it or not. But, you know, so I think we need to be prepared to set down the rules and to say, or to fix their devices in ways that say, all right, you can do this and this and this, and when you've shown me you understand a particular concept, like I check in with my body to see how it's feeling after I've been on a screen for a while, and I take a stretch break. You know, when your child can demonstrate that they have certain skill sets, then you say, okay, then you're allowed to do this. And we progress it as they grow older and give them more and more responsibilities with their devices.
Okay, I certainly understand all that. And I do understand the point that if a teenager says, I feel addicted to my phone, that's not the same as certainly being addicted. But if I say, well, does that just mean you're worried about missing out in your friend group, that that's where all the activity is? And they say, yes. I don't know that that makes me feel much better as a parent. And I'm curious to know, Faith, I mean, what's the follow-up there? I mean, it doesn't give me all that much comfort to say, well, you're not actually addicted. You're just, that's where all your social activity is, and that's why you have to feel like you're always on your phone. What do you do with that, Faith?
So I look at the broader life. If this is a child who is doing okay in school, involved in activities, you know, generally doing all right in life, then to me the answer is you accept it. This is, they're figuring out how to engage in their lives. And if they seem to be doing all right, and you see them spending a good amount of time on the phone, but it doesn't seem to be interfering with other things, then there is no real problem here. They may be doing exactly what you did as a teenager. They're just doing it differently because there are different opportunities. Kids don't have a lot of ways or places, literally physical places, to hang out with each other without adult supervision. And teenagers need places like that in order to develop socially. So very much often online is what provides that for them. That's not by itself unhealthy in any way. if they are seeing that there's another problem, if a child is withdrawn, if a child exhibits significant changes in behavior, then we start looking at next steps, right? But that's actually not the case for most kids. There was just a study that came out, I think, in the last 2 weeks from University of Wisconsin that found that two-thirds of adolescents who use screens have no problems with them. It's the one-third that we need to pay attention to, one-third that for whatever reason they're having problems in their life. And those are the ones that we need to focus on and say, you know what, we need to pay attention. But I think the big caveat there is if you just take away their phone, you're not solving the problem.
Okay, fair enough. But even one-third is millions of kids. I mean, like, we're talking a huge amount of kids, even if it's less than half. But all of that's well taken. Dr. Cook, I think I have to let you go in a second here. Anything you want to add there?
This is a really, really key point that was brought before. It's health literacy. It's media literacy. It's health literacy. It's understanding what's being given to us, thrown at us, promoted to us. You know, as a parent, and for centuries before me as a parent, there were not many, pureed type of fruits and veggies as toddler foods that are presented, you know, as a way to get your kids to eat their fruits and vegetables. Well, children survived and lived and thrived for centuries without those. And yet the food industry has created those to appear as a necessity. And it's the same here. It's what that balance is. And it is a crucial discussion with parents early. I talk about this as one of the first things I see with a parent when they come in. I'm like, screen time, whatever it is you use, allowing a toddler or an infant even to, you know, to handle and play with a phone, I worry about, you know, you're just normalizing that in your own mind. And it is a huge concern. A third of kids, especially teens, that's today. And now we're doing this in the past 2 years where we've had to rely on technology for certain things. You know, when we talk about getting back to normal, let's get back to normal and not have so many screen times, so much screen usage, especially in unhealthy ways. Again, it is a balance, and I think it's been some great points here by Faith that it's not framing this as addiction is just not a great way to frame it. It's got to be framed around excessive use, and really the parent has to be active in observing their use. And unfortunately, the technology leaves it the other way. They can have it, and then you don't have to be as active and engaged as a parent. And unfortunately, parents don't want to hear that.
Dr. Cook, I think I got to let you go for your schedule, but I am grateful for your time, as always. Thank you for being here with us on this beautiful Wednesday.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Dr. Steve Cook, who is a pediatrician at Golisano Children's Hospital. So let me turn to Dr. Murray, and I want to get you sort of your take on hard lines here, Dr. Murray. When we talk about the Wait Until 8th campaign, a little background on this for listeners. Back in 2016, a mom in Austin, Brooke Shannon, created that pledge, Wait Until 8th, asking parents to not give their kids a smartphone until at least age 14 or the 8th grade, as long as at least 10 other families from your child's grade and school pledge that as well. A little more than a year later, there were more than 2,000 commitments from parents in more than 500 schools in 49 states. From the campaign's website on access to texts and calls, it says the following, quote, "Every major carrier makes a basic phone that just calls and texts without a data plan if you believe your child will need to get in touch with you before 8th grade. The Wait Until 8th pledge is encouraging parents to delay the smartphone. If you would like your child to have a basic phone that just calls and texts or a two-way calling watch, you can still sign the pledge. The basic phone and two-way calling watch avoid many of the distractions and dangers of the smartphone," end quote. So at the core of this is this idea that is there a hard and fast line that no phone until 8th grade, no phone until age 13, 14, 15, 10, 16, whatever. And what Faith was talking about, Dr. Murray, and Faith, by the way, for listeners, is a PhD, an author, and a media literacy specialist, and a curriculum developer at insightereducation.com. the point is, the first question is not, well, what's the age? It's, are the parents ready for this? Are the parents involved? Are you ready to make the commitment? Is that how you view it, Dr. Murray? Or is it like, okay, that's true, but if they say they're going to do that at age 8, no 8-year-old is ready for a full self. I mean, like, how do you view that?
Well, it's a dyad, right? So it's, are the parents ready, but is the child ready as well? You know, I don't think there is a hard and fast age, because that would imply like you could flip a switch and all of a sudden a child has a skill, which we all wish to be the case as parents, but that's just not how mm-hmm. it is. You know, you can think of sixth graders and the tremendous variability within a sixth grade class in height and emotional abilities and maturity, all of the things. And so their ability to use a really powerful piece of technology is going to vary as well. So our kids are going to teach us when they're ready, as long as parents we know the signs. So again, it's a partnership. And it's not an all or nothing that our child will teach us that they have some basic skills and are ready to use it. And we need to have a discussion with them as far as what our expectations are and how we think that having access to a phone is potentially beneficial, but have a real honest conversation about there are potentially a lot of downsides. And because there are some dangers and downsides associated with, we need to have some rules and restrictions about it. You know, under really no circumstances does technology need to be in anybody's bedroom. You know, we don't need TVs, we don't need smartphones, we don't need tablets in bedrooms. That is a quiet, safe place for sleep. And staring at your phone in 20 minutes before you go to bed is really not so conducive to easing into sleep. And there are definitely some websites that we don't want kids going on to, but we need to know if they get there by accident as well. So starting out with your child using their technology, you know, at the kitchen table when somebody's kind of around, not necessarily hovering over their shoulder watching them, but just kind of in their environment and tuned in to what is going on, it is so important. But I think the key here is if both parties have to be ready and they have to be able to adjust and understand this is a dynamic process. It's not a here you go have fun, I'll see you when you need a new phone.
Okay, and when you talk about like that parental conversation about whether someone is developmentally ready, I think Faith is absolutely right that there is media literacy education that needs to happen. What are the kinds of questions? I mean, like, how do you have that conversation as a parent to really probe whether a kid can do this, Dr. Murray?
Well, I think it kind of depends on who's driving the bus on this one, right? Is it the parents concerned and they think that maybe it'd be beneficial for the child to have a phone, or is it the child coming to the parent? You know, if it's the child coming to the parent saying, I really, really want to have a phone, then you just say, tell me more about that. What is it that you're interested in doing? What do you feel that you're missing out on right now? And see where the answers take you. You know, it might be a very practical need of, you know, the other day I came home and you weren't home and you were supposed to be, and that made me really scared for a while or something. You know, there might be a very objective, clear reason that either is a one-off or something that maybe you hadn't thought of and is very reasonable. It, you know, who knows what their answer is going to be, but you can kind of gauge it and go from there and see where your child is as far as what is important to them. You know, things that sometimes are important to teenagers seem pretty insignificant to adults, but we have to remember, you know, their world is different than ours. They are in a different developmental place than us. And that's okay. And that's okay. And that can be really hard to navigate through. And, you know, as a parent of a tween myself, it can be a challenge. Even if you have a really great, well-adjusted kid, there's always going to be bumps in the road. And that's part of life. And having access to this powerful technology potentially offers up a few extra bumps.
Well, after we take our only break, we're going to come back and we've got listener feedback here. And interestingly enough, I should mention that Dr. Cook sent me this hour a study out of the University of Wisconsin with the following headline: most teens actually have healthy relationship with digital technology. I think that's part of what Faith has been telling us, which is that we don't need to have a moral panic here, that there isn't, you know, sort of massive and obvious immediate addiction. They're handling it better than we think, but there are problems and there are concerns that we should all deal with here, especially as parents, especially as caregivers. So let's take our only break of the hour and we'll come back to your phone calls and emails as we talk about kids, technology, the right age to get a phone or not. Maybe you saw that piece in the Washington Post that sparked our attention this week about parents who are kind of the firm no holdouts, the line in the sand, no phone. I don't care if you're a teenager, not happening. We'll talk much more about that with our guests on the other side of this break. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on the Next Connections, Rochester Bike Week kicks off next week. So what's the state of bike infrastructure locally? We talk specifically about new bike boulevards. Our team took a ride through Rochester with Jesse Piers from Reconnect Rochester and explored more than 8 miles of the bike boulevards. We talk about the progress. Talk with you Thursday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our guests include Dr. Elizabeth Murray, a pediatrician at Golisano Children's Hospital, and Faith Rogo, who is a PhD, author, and media literacy specialist and curriculum developer at insiderseducation.com. Matt in Canandaigua on the phone first. Hi, Matt. Go ahead.
Hey, Evan. Thanks for taking my call. I'll just share my my experience as being a father with a sixth grader who's had a cell phone since he was a smartphone since she was in fourth grade. And I understand some of the concerns people bring up. There are options for parents. There's apps so you can monitor or see what they're doing. Parents should be proactive. Have guidelines like no phone after this time. But as far as emerging technologies, I mean, for my generation, it was AOL Instant Messenger. For this generation, Snapchat. It's just a way they're communicating with their friends. And frankly, it's been kind of beneficial in the past when she's been able to text me during her lunch period or send me a message through Messenger saying, hey, I forgot my track shoes. Can you drop them off? Things like that. Where in the past, you know, they would have to go to the school office and call and, I don't know. I mean, I understand there's threats out there, but there's threats in the real world. The other day we were at the park and, you know, she's in sixth grade, so she avoids me like the plague in public, but she was getting catcalled by a bunch of teenage boys. Mm. So, I mean, this is the reality of our world. And frankly, the technology is just going to keep on advancing. You already see things like Elon Musk working on Neuralink. Who knows what that potentially can lead to. Those are just my comments as a regular parent. Those are my thoughts. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, thank you, Matt. I appreciate it. Faith Rogo, what do you make of that?
So, yeah, it's a part of life. And for those parents who are saying, oh, I'm not going to give my kids a phone, it's not that you have to. It's that don't kid yourself into thinking they're not being exposed to this stuff if they don't have one. That oftentimes, very much, they are. It's part of their culture. So that would be one thing. And it's why, for me, so much of the answer has to be we have to figure out the way to equip them with the skills that they need. And, you know, before I would hand a phone to a child, I would want to make sure that we've had conversations and they've demonstrated to me skills around things like I know when it's okay to take a picture and when it's not. I know when it's okay to share that picture and when it's not. I know how to respond if somebody bullies me online and what the possible responses are to that. All of those kinds of very specific, significant conversations need to happen if we're going to give kids phones. And that's true whether, you know, you're giving the phone at age 9, like this last caller did, or 14 or 15 or 16 to kind of draw a line at a particular age. I don't want that to lull people into thinking, okay, well, they're above that age, they're good to go now. Not if you haven't had those conversations with them.
Dr. Murray, what do you think about Matt's phone call?
Yeah, it's working for him, and that's fine. Again, there's no magic switch that's going to be flipped. If there is benefits to his family and they are having the right conversations and they're approaching it as a skill and a tool, then that's going to be fine for them. And that's okay. It's just all the stuff that we've been talking about making sure we're not just tossing it in the kid's hands and walking away, just like we would never give a teenager keys to the car and just say, you'll figure it out, it'll be fine. We can't be doing that with this new piece of technology either. It's not going away. It is going to just continue to evolve. You know, all of us who were great at Atari can't do so great with the video games nowadays because we haven't kept up with it. But, you know, we need to, as parents, keep up with the latest things, because I can guarantee our kids are.
Here's a different take. Charles via email says, I'm all for cutting phones out. As far as I'm concerned, my future children will be given Nokia 4300 4Gs, and that's it. If they want entertainment, they have a place called The Outdoors, which is infinitely more fun and also has the advantage of preventing people from becoming fat. There is a slight pitfall that I can see, however. Literally today, Apple announced that their remaining iPod Touches will be sold off and no longer produced. People don't carry a phone, camera, and a separate MP3 player anymore. It's increasingly one device. Good for convenience, bad for age-appropriate phone purchases. That is Charles via email. Dr. Murray, let me start with you. What do you think?
Yes, I mean, I think that is a possibility, but I think it's very true that one thing we do have to face is that some of the simpler, older technology is going to just go away and not be functional anymore. Colleague here at work who's in the office next to me, she was adamant that she was keeping a flip phone until it just would not work anymore and there was no more flip phone available that she could use, and she upgraded finally to a smartphone. But she didn't want to, and I get it. I think, though, just because a child potentially has a smartphone, all those services, devices, things that go with it don't necessarily have to be turned on. You know, it's not any time a situation where all has to be lost because you have access to a phone. Kids should definitely be playing outside, should be playing as much as possible. Play is the work of childhood, right? And they need creative outlets. They need to have different times. But I think we also have to appreciate that there are some cool things with technology that kids can do to supplement what they're doing in their actual physical environment too, whether it be kind of some graphic design projects or other things. I mean, we have to figure out a way to live harmoniously with this technology because it's not going away. And we can definitely come up with ways to teach our children to be respectful of it and to be safe consumers of it, and also maintain their physical, mental, emotional health through all the other good things we know to do. It has to be a balance, and we can do it.
Okay. Faith, what do you think?
Yeah, I think balance really is probably one of the key words to repeat over and over and over again. And to get away from the kind of either or, either they're outside or they use technology. Lots of people who do lots of outdoor stuff also use technology. Sometimes they combine them, and sometimes we set aside space or time to say, you know what, this is device-free time, or this is device-free space. Some people from their religious traditions will take the Sabbath and say, this is device-free time. Other people will just say, you know what, we do family dinners, so we're going to say during mealtime, no one takes out a device. I think it was Dr. Murray who said the earlier advice about bedtime not being a great time for devices. There's a huge body of research now that suggests that that is true. So I think that there are ways to do that. I also think we have to be, you know, we want to pay attention to how they're using them when they are doing outdoor things. One of the things we know that is that kids who are very involved in athletics also tend to use devices a lot to keep track of their teams, to, you know, talk to people about what they're doing. You know, there are all kinds of apps to help people explore the outdoors, from map apps for a hiking trail, to things like there's an app called Merlin that lets you open the recording device on your smartphone and record a bird song, and it'll help you identify the bird. Just all kinds of possibilities. We want to encourage children to explore those possibilities, things they can do that are great things with this tool that they now have in their hands. And maybe that will kind of balance out some of the fears. and I want to say one other thing, that the be really careful about where the fears of this technology come from, because very often they come from media reports, and a little bit of media literacy will tell you that commercial media make more money from the sensational than they do the mundane. So they're going to report, oh, this is, you know, making zombies out of kids, this device. And they're not going to report on, actually, this is kind of a pretty nuanced topic. Yeah, nothing much to really see here, right? Because they're not going to make money. They're not going to get clicks from that kind of reporting. They get clicks from the zombie report. So be really careful before you've decided, oh, this is scary, this is dangerous, this is all bad. Really, where are you getting that information from? Do a little bit of media analysis kind of your sources.
All right, let me squeeze in two more phone calls, George and Mike, and we'll get our guest thoughts here. George first in Brighton. Hi, George, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Evan.
Sure.
I guess I just want to comment as a parent. My daughter is 6, going on 7. She's in first grade. You know, listening to this past segment, I definitely agree with the panel. I kind of fall somewhere in the middle, right? It doesn't have to be an all or nothing prospect in terms of using a device. I kind of consider it a tool, a parenting tool. You know, it's fun when they have it. There are times and places for her to use it. I like to consider it kind of a nuclear option. You know, certainly if we're out to dinner or something and we just want to have a conversation and she just needs to be occupied for a little while, you know, we'll give her that option. But I think the panel's right. I mean, it's something that you need to manage correctly. You need to be aware of. I don't think it's anything to be afraid of, you know, especially if you're doing it correctly. You know, I think of the kids that never are allowed to have junk food, and then they go to their friend's house who has all the junk food, and they go crazy with it. You know, I think in moderation, it's effective, and, you know, like the panel has said, they eventually learn how to use it appropriately and responsibly.
Yeah, I appreciate that, George. I mean, that goes to what Faith was saying about don't just assume that if you take an abstinence-only approach to this, that your kid will not experience some of this elsewhere, similar to what you're talking about with junk food. So that's one perspective. Let me get Mike, and then we'll have our guests respond to both these calls. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hey, Evan. How you doing?
Good, sir.
Thanks for taking the call. I have a little bit of an unusual experience with my daughter, who was 10 years old at the time of this story. It was maybe 12 years ago now. But we were going through a difficult divorce at the time and early on in it, and the emotions in the family were running quite high. Her older brothers had cell phones at the time. She did not. And I got her a cell phone at age 10, and I was not living in the house. She was at home with her mom and her brothers. But I got her. I would not ordinarily have done that. At age 10, and in those days especially, things maybe have changed in 10 years since then. But it was primarily so that I could have a reliable source of channel for communicating with her and connecting with her. And I wasn't sure in the situation at the time that I would have otherwise. It's a little hard to explain, and I'm not throwing any stones or, you know, getting into the details of the thing. But I had the clear idea at the time that if she had a cell phone, if I got her own phone, nobody was going to take it away from her. It was just a kind of thing where that would have been a tough move for a mom or anybody to make.
Okay. And it's worked out, secure
kind of thing.
And it's worked out, you say?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
It worked out great. At the time, you know, we were like using it respectfully and appropriately and actually texting a little bit at night after she went to bed and saying, good night, honey, that sort of thing. And it was a connection that was, I felt, really important to maintain.
Okay. I appreciate that, Mike. Mike and George, two different points of view there. Dr. Murray, about 40 seconds. What do you make of those?
Yeah, you know, special times called for special things. You know, during the pandemic, the American Academy of Pediatrics certainly clearly, you know, acknowledged that space time with relatives, more technology time was going to be needed, and that was okay. It served a very good purpose. And for that caller, it served a very clear purpose of actually increasing connection with his daughter, and that is totally fine. We can use tools to help us, and as long as we're acknowledging the work we want the tool to do for us, then we should be okay. We just go back to the original stuff. We have to understand how these tools work. We have to understand the rules around them and the responsibility that's needed with them. And for the first caller, teaching those kids at 6, 7, 8 about the responsibility, even if they don't have their own device, mm-hmm. is the best time to start.
Yeah. About 30 seconds to close this out. Faith, final thoughts from you.
Sure. It's all about developing healthy habits. And you can't develop a habit around how to use a device in a healthy way if you never have access to having that device.
That's a strong point there, but a lot, I think, about modeling and what parents understand here and the involvement of parents. Really, I think, a fascinating conversation, and I hope, as Faith Rogo would say, not a sensationalistic one. Faith is a PhD author and media literacy specialist and curriculum developer at insiderseducation.com. Thank you for being with us this hour, Faith.
My pleasure.
Dr. Elizabeth Murray, a pediatrician at Golisano Children's Hospital, among the many hats she wears, communicating with our community. Thank you, Dr. Murray, for being with us again.
Happy to do it. Thank you.
And however you are listening to this program, I hope you are a member of your public radio community. Go to wxxi.org/give. Thanks for listening. We're back with you tomorrow.